This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Stutz Terkel, who records stories of American life by letting Americans speak for themselves. His best-selling books of oral history include Working, About Life on the Job, Hard Times, Memories of the Great Depression, and The Good War, about World War II. Stutz Terkel also hosts a popular syndicated radio interview show, which originates in his hometown, Chicago. There he uses his interviewing skills for prompting insights and anecdotes from more celebrated personalities. To his readers and listeners, the 73-year-old Terkel has become an American folk figure in his own right. Before we discussed his life, I wanted to know about his interviewing style. I asked him if he has a different approach for interviewing famous and uncelebrated people.
No, it's the same. Naturally, when someone wrote a book, I got to read the book. And that takes time. Now, I interview a person, the non-celebrated person, so-called, it's to find out what that person is thinking, but you're exploring new territory. I say I'm like Columbus discovering a new land, and that this person has never been asked about her life before. And that person opens up, and a marvelous thing happens sometimes. And these are those great occasions when that person, in the days when the tape recorder was not as ubiquitous as it is now, that person, hey, could you play that back? I want to hear my voice. And the kids are around her, and you play it back, and that person says, you know, I never knew I felt that way before. I never knew I felt that way before. It's a tremendous moment of revelation for that person, and of course for me too. I'm kind of like a fellow passenger on a trip, in a way.
How far will you push, though, when you're doing a personal interview? Because some people really want to get someone to confide all their secrets and to break down and cry and reveal
mine's exactly
these
the
deep
opposite.
Emotional things.
No, mine's exactly the opposite. I never trespass on what I think is private domain of a person. But the person is telling me something that reveals a facet of a life, and it's personal, but it only because it reveals a facet of a life. That's a different thing. But just not gossip. No time for that. I'll tell you a story, okay? Years ago, I was interviewing Diana Barrymore. Diana Barrymore was the daughter of the great actor John Barrymore, and she died a number of years ago. Diana Barrymore, at that time, was the subject of Scandal magazine. It was a horrible magazine called Confidential. And they go into her sex life, bizarre, her junkiness, her drinking. And it's just, then she acts in a Tennessee Williams play, suddenly last summer in Chicago. And she's wonderful. She was a marvelous actress in this play, the girl who's lobotomized. Later on, she did Maggie in Cat on a Hot Tin. So after seeing her in the Tennessee Williams play, I interviewed her, and we're talking about Tennessee Williams, the heroines, what they mean to her. And then we finished the interview, and it's rather good, I thought. She said, haven't you forgotten something? I said, well, I've forgotten a lot of things. What? You haven't asked me those questions. I said, what questions? Well, those questions about my life, you know, that everybody else asks. I said, none of my business. I says, nor the business of the reason. I want to find out about you through your artistry, through your craft. If I had Frank Lloyd Wright on, the architect, would I ask him about his wives, whom he left, or left him, or I ask about his architecture and why the Imperial Hotel withstood the Japanese earthquake, you know. And so when you're asked you how you attack this girl, the role, and then she busts out crying. She says, no one has ever said that to me before. She came to accept that as in the normal way of things, to accept humiliation. Well, I don't do it. Serves no purpose. I don't do none of my business. That's like peeking through a keyhole or peeking through a transom. And, of course, I resent that very much. So the person tells me of his life with something involving that makes it universal. That's it. It's when somebody reads this, that happened to me. I thought the same thing. That's what I look for. A certain universality in a specific.
Do you think your interviewing's gone through different stages? You know, is the way you interview now the way you started when you began
interviewing? I don't know. Gee, I can't. I think it's different. I think I've gotten older and more of a easier way, I think. I'm not sure. I think you learn as you go along. You learn different people. But you still have to go round and round and round the mulberry bush. I mean, you're still, it's a conversation. And then, rather than interview. Because sometimes I say something about myself, maybe, too, if it helps, you know. Very often, you know, here's a tale out of school. I'm not very good mechanically. You know, I use the tape recorder, right? The tape recorder is my right arm. I don't know how it works. You know, I can't drive a car. So I goof up a lot, unintentionally. That person helps me, the person I'm interviewing. When that person helps me, something happens. That person feels needed by me. And to feel needed is terribly important. Many people don't feel needed, you see. So there's no one way. I clown around, horse around. And
so it's important for you to not be the star when you're interviewing somebody, the famous Studs Terkel interviewing someone.
No, well, you see, that becomes, I got to watch that, you see. Isn't that funny? You said the famous Studs Terkel. This is a guy who is, in a half-ass way, sort of celebrated for interviewing non-celebrated people, which is ironic, is it not, you know? If I took that seriously, I'd be a real oaf, wouldn't I, and a clod. Maybe I am, but I don't take it seriously. No.
I know you have been interviewed around the country on radio and TV shows, but do you watch and listen to interview shows when you're at home, or does it drive you crazy to hear interviews after doing all the ones that you do?
It drives me crazy. Particularly the political ones, you know, when you watch those great newspaper guys on the Sunday morning shows, never ask the pertinent question. They don't, you see. We, unlike Russia and China, where there's a heavy hand of government, we know that. And so, guys, they have to be samizdatish, you know, they have to have underground ways of talking and codes. We don't have a heavy hand of government. We have something different, self-censorship. These guys and women know exactly what not to ask. They never ask about this bloated military budget, really. They never say this is lunacy to build more and more nuclear missiles if we can knock them 50 times over and they can do the same to us. They never ask why cuts are always in human resources and never the. They never say the welfare bums in the Pentagon, where the big welfare bums really are. You see, do they ever? No, they know you don't ask those questions. Now, that's censorship. Very subtle indeed, but it's there, just as heavy as the other.
So the political interviews frustrate you. What about interviews with authors and performers who you'd see on TV?
Authors, it depends if the person read the book or not, you know. And then I see authors sometimes being interviewed, good authors, you know, going through this humiliating experience, you know. There's a pretense. The pretense to the audience is the author has to pretend the person read the book. The person has to pretend he read the book. And the audience watching has to pretend that having a conversation.
I must say, I've interviewed several people who you've interviewed, and one of the things that many of them have said is like, God, I walked into the studio and there was a copy of my book. And it was dog-eared, and it was scribbled on, and I was so happy. He'd not only read it, but he'd written all over it.
You know what I do is I read it. I got to read it. So I'm up to 4 in the morning. If I interview someone who wrote a book, I have to respect that person and the book. I won't interview Harold Robbins or Rona Jaffe or Belva Plaine. Why? You know, why? Life is too short. I interview, let's say, Michael Arlen's new book. Michael Arlen, I'm going to miss him now because we goofed up on schedules. Or whoever it is I'm interviewing, you know, John Cheever when he was alive, you know, something. That's a different thing. You got to read. So I mark. I look for, now and then, look for a crazy kind of passage that I call revelatory, you know, that sets things on fire. But I mark it, and it looks like hieroglyphics, and it's a crazy goof. Sometimes I put music in. You see, sometimes it might be a book that I might, if I'm talking about, well, I did an interview, she died long ago, Flannery O'Connor. I read her short stories. I bring in some wild banjo music between in a background of a story called Parker's Back or something. So I do all kinds of things.
What do you do when you're interviewing a politician? I know you've interviewed political people, and they're not being straight with you. They're giving you like the line, or they're using like bureaucratic language to obscure what they're saying.
I don't interview political people, not during a campaign. Never. I can't. I don't do that because then I got to have clouds on. I have no time. Again, I have no time for that. See, people say, why don't I have people of the real right on my show? I say, I got no time for that. I got no time. They got forums. They can be on. They got 1.5 million forums. God Almighty, they don't need. I'm sorry, but now and then, when my books, that's different. In my books, I want to get, like in Hard Times, I interviewed Gerald L. K. Smith. Now, Gerald L. K. Smith was a very colorful American fascist. He was. He didn't deny it. He's dead now. He was known as an anti-Semite. And I had to interview him because he was in that time, the Depression. He had tremendous power in certain communities. Henry Ford brought him up north to fight the Union, you know, to split blacks and whites. But he was remarkably colorful. But I let him talk himself. Went to see him in Fayetteville in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And so he's talking, during the civil rights time, I interviewed him. He's talking about these young clergymen, these guys. I'm a clergyman. He says, don't call me Reverend, but just call me Mr. Smith. These guys hide behind that turned back collar as they're fighting for civil rights. Let them be like me. I face it. And the same breath, just about 2 seconds afterward, he's describing an event in the 30s. I was attacked. They almost tried to lynch me in Georgia, and I hopped on that rock. You know, these Roosevelt guys tried to hop on the rock and say, who dares attack me? Attacks a man of God. So he's contradicting himself in the same breath. Let him do it. I don't do it, you see. But I have to capture people as they are.
When you interview someone for one of your books, I'm sure you can spend hours or days talking with them as much as you need. But for the radio show, you have, say, an hour.
Mm-hmm.
When that hour's over, even if you feel like you've really gotten to hear a lot about that person, do you ever walk out feeling, well, how much do I really know? You know, and like, is the way they presented themselves in the hour really the essence of who they are?
Well, that always comes up. The author of a book, you try to get whatever the essence of the book is, the theme of the book, maybe read from it, too. He and I, or she and I, both read together. He and I read together, because I'm a ham bone, too. I used to be a Chicago gangster, you know, in radio soap operas. You know, I was a gangster in the days when radio soap operas, a lot of them came out of Chicago, Ma Perkins, you know. And then she was a good middle American family. I was always the guy who says, get in there, you guys. That was me. And then it was Mary Marlin. I gave her a very hard time. You know, she suffered more than St. Teresa ever did, Monday through Fridays, courtesy of Oxidol. And then, but the one I remember best, Betty and Bob. You know why I remember that? The actress who played the role of Betty's mother, these were horrendous scripts. Oh, but the scripts were all the same. You couldn't tell one from the other, and they're very forgettable. But the actress, her name was Edie Davis, a very elegant-looking actress, silver-haired, and I used to threaten her in the soap opera. And then I forgot the script, I forgot her, I forgot what I did. Years passed, about 40 years passed. It's election night, 1980. President-elect Ronald Reagan, his wife, Nancy Davis Reagan, and references made to his wife's mother, the mother-in-law of the new president, Edie Davis. That's the woman I was in a soap opera with. And that's when I had what I call my epiphanic experience, what Joyce calls his epiphanic, my moment of revelation. I was Saul on the road to Damascus, right? And I got that blinding light. And you know what the revelation was?
What?
Thinking about Betty and Bob and Edie Davis and 40 years later and the president, you can no longer tell where soap opera leaves off and life begins. That's it. And it was a soap opera. The sky and the world we live in. The great man. And so this is what I find frightening. Funny, but frightening at the same time. But anyway, I always like metaphors and anecdotes, you know. In a way, if they reveal, if the anecdote becomes metaphorical, it has a value. Otherwise, I become a bore.
I'm speaking with Studs Terkel, if you're just joining us, and he's had a very popular interview show on the radio, which is syndicated for many years. It originates at WFMT in Chicago. He's written several books of oral histories. His latest is called The Good War, and it's oral histories with men and women talking about their experiences during World War II. You've been in Chicago all your life, except for the times when you've been traveling. Why are you that committed to the city? What makes that city really special for you?
Chicago is my home, and I'm there, and it's a kind of, even though I romanticize, a kind of muscularity to it, and its reputation, thanks to Jimmy Cagney and Warner Brothers and Edward G. Robinson, is still boom, boom. You know, it's Chicago was always a corrupt city, but no more corrupt than other cities. But I call it the big daddy of corrupt cities. And as the respectables are secretly proud when someone goes, Chicago, boom, boom. They're secretly proud of it, in a way.
Did you ever want to move to, like, the West Coast or the East Coast and go to New York to or Los Angeles to work at one of the networks?
Never, never. Never in a million years. There was a time in the early 1950, 51, I was a part of a program called Studs Place. It was early TV. At that time, I got a call to come to New York. And I got so scared to direct Billy Rose, of all things, a Billy Rose program. And I said, no, I really couldn't. I didn't want to go there. I had no more business being there than the man. You know, the old cliche, good to visit, but that's it. No, so there was that one momentary offer. If I'd have died, it's like being without water, you know. My roots are in Chicago. I'm there. It's freewheeling as far as I'm concerned. Whether I could do it in another city, I don't know. It's free. I'm kind of a freewheeler, you know.
Have you ever lost any radio sponsors because of your politics?
Oh, way in the back. Oh, there was a period in the 50s. Before I came to the station, FMT, boy, there was an FMT. I was blacklisted. Oh, sure. Studs Place was knocked off for that reason. And so I remember a VP of... I was considered, forgive this phrase, a valuable property. Property is interesting. Because the show was quite popular. It was a kind of program that had an audience of cut through. It had an audience of... mainline-type ladies who write in a boss stationery, or a charwoman, a scrub lady signing with an ex. Her daughter writes the letter. Truck driver, college professor. It was one of those programs. Well, anyway, the show was, finally, it was the McCarthy time, and I signed petitions, anything, you know, anti-Jim Crow. That was considered subversive back then. I'm talking about the 50s now, before the 60s. Oh, whatever I signed, price control, rent control. So I get a I'm called to this office in Chicago, and they tell me, gee, I'm a valuable guy. Why am I doing this? You know, I said, well, all I got to say is I've been duped. See, you've been a fool. But I wasn't. I said, see, it's my own ego. It's not my heroism. It's my ego. How dare you say it was one of the few good things I did. I said, of course I signed it. Well, you know, some Reds signed it, too. He said, I don't give a damn if they did. I'm reading what it says, and I like that, and I signed it. Well, you weren't duped. Do you want to say, no, I don't want to look like a fool. It's my ego, you see. So then he says, you know, you got to, an American, you got to stand up and be counted. So I'm sitting in a chair. So I stood up at attention. And they said, we don't think that's very funny. I said, well, I think it's kind of funny. Anyway, you're out, you know. I says, yeah, I guess so. So I was out, you know, for quite a while, off and on. But pick up half a bill here and there, lecturing on jazz or something, or I get it, and finally got back on. And one day I was listening to this small station called WFMT, and they're playing a Woody Guthrie record. Well, no one ever played Woody Guthrie on the radio except me on a disc jockey show I did years in 1945 called The Wax Museum. And they played Woody. I forget the song. It might have been Tom Joad or Going Down the Road Feeling Bad, a Dust Bowl ballad. And I call up and say, you're playing Woody Guthrie. And I told my name, and she said, they knew me. I said, listen, I want to work for you. She says, we have no money. And I said, I don't have any either, so it makes us even. So I started working at that station. Well, the station became a very good classical music station, probably the best, if I say so, the best in the country. It is. It carries Chicago Symphony, live, lyric opera, Salzburg Festival, you know, Glyndebourne, BBC programs. And it's one aberration. I do my 1 hour. And so the station grew, and there I am.
Did you grow up in a liberal family? Was your mother liberal?
No, hardworking. My father was a liberal. My mother was out for the brass ring, you know, and she missed. She ran the hotel. My father did, too, but he was ill. And she was pretty shrewd, pretty bright in money matters, but nobody could take her except a guy named Samuel Insull, who was a big utilities tycoon, took a lot of people to Chicago then. But she always missed the brass ring. But in the hotel where I was raised, in this hotel. It was a men's hotel. But in those days, when you say men's hotel, you don't mean flop house. This was not. This was skilled craftsmen living there. I'm talking about the 20s now. Transient guys who were boomer firemen. carpenters, guys skilled, and a lot of them were self-educated, were autodidacts, you know, and self-taught, and they were argued in the lobby, and that was a big factor in my life, I'd say.
Would you talk to people when you were a kid who were
really... Well, I was there. I was kind of the pet. I was a happy child. I was kind of the pet, you know, of the guys and of the people, of my family, too. And I'd go to see plays when I was 13 years old, because we lived right near downtown, the Loop, the hotel. And so I liked to see... So one thing led to another, really.
You went to law school and then left that in favor of acting.
And then
radio
law
performance.
School.
Yeah, why'd you leave law school?
I went to law school, the dream of Clarence Darrow, you know, attorney of the damned. That was the dream. But then I had torts, and then I had contracts, then I had real property. And then this is incredible. I can't hit these legalisms. So it was three unhappy years for me. And people say, you never lose. You know, you never forget law school. Always is good. Baloney. It was three wasted years. I might as well say it.
How'd you break into acting after that?
Again, accidental. The depression. There was a depression. And I had a civil service job in Washington. And you dream. I dreamed of a civil service job. 9 to 5. And it paid $12.60 a year. It was the second lowest, CAF-2 it was called. And we'd count baby bonds. The World War I veterans got a second bonus payoff. And we had one of these big examinations. It took 3-4 days. The cream of the crop were picked. And then all we was count. But any event, I came back to Chicago, and I was on a statistical project at the time, a New Deal project. And one of the members of it was a director of a theater group. And they were doing a play called Waiting for Lefty by Clifford Odets, a play of the 30s. And I went there because I like theater. He's going to stage, do a role, read it. And that's how I became an actor. And I was in the first play I was in was Waiting for Lefty. It was about a taxi cab driver strike. Clifford Odets, who became the playwright of Social Significance of the 30s, Awake and Sing, and all those.
In your memoir, Talking to Myself, you talk about a scene in the movie Five Easy Pieces. Why don't you share impressions of that? Because that's such a classic scene, love what you have to say about it.
Five Easy Pieces. I know young listeners love this movie, and it was a good, slick movie. I say slick. And it was very good. It just happened. Before seeing, I interviewed a waitress for the book Working. I remember her name. She's now dead. She was a wonderful woman. Yolanda Leaf. I call her Dolores Dante in the book. Now and then change your name. But in almost every case, I say, we should use my real name. I do it maybe because they might be embarrassed, but they weren't. Anyway, so I view this. She's describing her daily work, a waitress, her work. And then I see the movie. And the key scene in that movie, the one they use all the time in the Academy Awards, is this virago. Here's Jack Nicholson. I'm not blaming him. I'm talking about the character. This guy's going to go to Alaska. He's a great piano virtuoso. And my feeling is, go ahead. I'm not stopping you. You want to go to Alaska? Go ahead. You're a pretty dull guy, you know? I mean, this is the self-indulgence. I'm talking about the character. And he's there with these companions in this restaurant. And here comes the villain, the waitress, the virago. And soon she comes on, you know, she's a wrongo. She throws the menu down. He's got, I have a change. I forget the exact scene. But they want a substitution. There's no substitution. Suddenly, and she's behaving so bad that he throws the stuff on the floor. And the kids in the audience, seeing the film, stood up and they cheered. And I'm saying, you little so-and-sos, you don't know who this waitress is. This is a setup. Is she tired? How are her varicose veins? Waitresses get a lot of varicose veins. So do stewardesses on planes. How many bufferins did she take? Why is she a waitress? The husband left her, he's dead, he's sick, kid's in trouble. How tired is she? Did she have a fight with the chef just then behind the doors? They know nothing about her, other than they cheered when he was showing her up. Well, I was so furious about that, because it tells those kids, these people who work aren't much. These are the same yuppies today on the campuses. They know nothing. Nothing about history or the nature of life, you know. And so I was so furious. Working taught me, yeah. It taught me. I'm impatient a lot with a telephone operator. No, I know what a telephone operator's life is like. But the great reward comes when I get a letter now and then from somebody. Or this was a young priest walking along the Michigan Avenue Bridge teaching at a school, at a seminary. And he says, you know, my kid said to me, on reading Working, he had Working assigned, they'll never again talk to a waitress the way they did before, or they'll never again talk to a truck driver the way they did. Well, that's good stuff. That's a reward, yeah. If it can alter a person's attitude, a book, well, you got something.
In your book, Working, you interviewed a lot of people who had 9-to-5 jobs that they did and that were hard, but it wasn't a kind of like life's work to them. It wasn't, for some it was, but I mean, for some of the people, they were like waitresses and wished that they didn't have to do it. You've had the opportunity to have a kind of life's work that is very meaningful to you. Yeah. Do you consider that like a great gift to be able to do that?
It's good fortune. For me, it's good fortune. Because imagine the great many people are doing work of which they don't see the end result. You see, the guy who's a spot welder in a plant, in contrast to the old cabinet maker, makes the whole thing. But also, see, remember, Freud Civilization Discontents spoke of work, Leben und Arbeiten, love and work, or sex and work, as the two prime impulses of human beings. And so there were a lot of books about sex, but very few about work at the time Working came out, you know. And so that was the dirty little secret, dirty big secret, work. D.H. Lawrence called sex dirty little secret. But work was the dirty big secret, because work is an extension of a person. And if that work is meaningless, the person's life becomes meaningless, you see. And so talking about work became terribly important to a great many people.
Since your work is really fulfilling, do you ever want to retire from it?
No, with my shoes turned up. Now, how could I retire? How could I retire? I'd have to be fired or, you know, knocked off. It's as long as I can talk. Or if I feel my marbles are lessening, you know, and if I got to feel that my standards are going down. If they are, I'd have to. My model would be the late Lotta Lehmann, the great leader singer and the greatest of a century. Lotta Lehmann retired one day. She surprised her audience at town hall. She was no more than 60 if she was at 61. She says, this is my last performance, and it's on recording, and I have it. It's a fantastic moment. And nobody, even her accompanist, Paul Lanusky, doesn't know it. And the audience, no, she's yes, yes. Let me tell you why. She's known for a famous role, the Marshalin in The Rosen Cavalier. And the Marshalin sees the first wrinkle. Still a beautiful woman, 35 maybe, gives up her young lover to the young girl. And she's the Marshalin taught me something. When that moment, when my height is lessening, I'm finishing. And she became a great teacher, of course. But Lotta Lehmann, to me, is a model of the way things should be for someone who's proud of his or her work.
Author and broadcaster Studs Terkel.